thankfully, now we did it. What myself and Paul thought was incredible when we watched Mark and Shane's race after.
Sorry, have we got two people on the line here?
Oh, yeah, we've Gary here. No, I'm Gary O'Donovan. Anyway,
why not?
You, Paul, and Shane as well.
Hello.
Sorry, so let me just do a name check here.
Good luck with this one, Joe.
Right, we've got Mark O'Donovan there, yeah? No relation. We've got Gary O'Donovan there.
Yeah.
We've got Paul O'Donovan there.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And have we Shane O'Driscoll?
We do, indeed.
And is Denise Walsh there?
No.
She'd more sense.
The boot is closed. She can't hear you. Anyway, back to where we were.
Go on. Hang on. Who's
Gary.
Introduce yourself.
You're going to need to say your name before you talk. Gary, I think that's you.
Gary.
Right, go on.
Yeah, it's Gary.
So you were watching the race?
We watched the race afterwards on the internet. And what was incredible about Mark and Shane was that when they went off the start, they went off at an incredibly high pace. And what most crews do is they walk very, very fast and settle into a race pace rhythm. But Mark and Shane's race pace rhythm was the very same as our absolute flat-out sprint at the finish of our race.
Right.
We were doing 42 strokes a minute at the very end of the race, sprinting for the finish line. And Mark and Shane were doing 43 and 44 strokes a minute down the hallway, down the course. And that kind of thing is unheard of. Like, we don't know how they did it. That feat was exceptional in itself, whatever about getting the medal.
Yeah, sure. So, Mark, you're 28. Shane, you're 24.
Like, what's this got to do with anything?
Well, I'm just giving people context because they mightn't be familiar with your stories.
Oh, we're all very, very young. Yeah, people have been giving out to me that I'm too old. We're young at heart. Now even younger at heart. We're like children there, aren't they?
Yeah.
Keep me young.
I was going to ask you, Mark and Shane. So, have you been a partnership for a long time at this stage, or is this a relatively new thing?
We've been together 3 years now on the road, in the same category, and doing the lightweight pair, so this is our third season.
Right, okay.
This is Paul now. I'm just going to add in there that Mark and Shane actually lived in the same bedroom above a pub for a couple of months before. Like, I mean, how long were you in the pub together that time?
Too long.
They were never out of each other's hair, like, so they're practically the same person there, you know?
It's a shame every Saturday night there would be music on in the pub low, so we'd never really get to sleep too early. It'd be about 3 o'clock and we'd have to be up early Sunday morning for training. So
this is Paul again. It's a wonder how you didn't go down.
That's definitely
down.
Gary, by the way. There's no chance. You could get away with that once, Gary, not twice.
What are you lads doing in the car now? Where are you going?
God knows.
We just had the dinner there. Yeah.
Where?
The West Cork Hotel there. Barry started us out. He was very good.
Right, okay. Have you got another reception to go to tonight, or is there more celebration?
Well, we're watching the TV there, and your one in RT was on.
And the guest was on silent inside in the restaurant, like, and
apparently they're waiting for us somewhere. But
we looked at the TV and we go, "Oh, geez, the lads are on again," and they turn on the volume.
Apparently they're all out in church class waiting for us or something.
Right.
So we'll go out there. We're meant to be out there in a few minutes, but listen, we're talking tea and we're having the crack.
No, listen, we appreciate it. What was last night like? I'm told there were bonfires last night and it was an amazing night. Can you tell us about last night?
The amount of illegal documents that got burnt was unbelievable. Last year it was all about burning beds and doors. This year it was illegal documents. You know, even the bank. The banks are out there getting rid of it. There's everyone's bank drafts. We're up at the
amount of ham sandwiches that were made as well and eaten.
Oh yeah, ham sandwiches.
Over in Ross,
chicken goujons with little sticks inside them. They looked after us very well over in the Celtic Cross, so we can't fault them one bit. In fairness, everyone at home is great, you know, and to be all looking out for us and all the rowers. And it's not just us, you know. I know we're probably the face of rowing around here, but you know, all the younger athletes and the youngsters coming up in the club, they're all known locally and around the place as the youngsters in the rowing club, and everyone looks after them and wishes them well, and they're always asking how they're getting on, because they'll be competing domestically and some of them are competing internationally at smaller regattas for Ireland, and you know, they're all like little superstars around the place as well as ourselves, you know.
Did I hear that you lads didn't even get a shower yesterday? It was straight on the plane home.
You're correct when you say that, yeah. It was so tight on the time. If we were to try and make it into Ireland, we had to pack up the boats, otherwise
we'd have no boats to come home and row. So things are very, very tight on time. We barely got a bit of food.
It was a race in itself to get on the aeroplane. We got a quick ham sandwich on the way.
We actually washed ourselves with a water bottle and a towel.
We drowned the towel in water and washed ourselves.
It wasn't a great job. We had no shampoo. But we're clean now, you can be sure of that.
Oh, yeah. I probably drew another one.
I don't want to say you gave it too much respect or how you treated the final, but you went and you played the final and it didn't go so well. But listen to you talk about the second final. There was almost an element of, I don't give a damn if it's not on final. I don't give a damn who I'm playing against. I don't care about the crowd. I don't care about the weather. I have to play well. I have to play well. It's that important. And that's almost the advice you should give to every young player.
Absolutely.
Forget the parade.
Yes.
Forget the anthem.
Yes.
Forget all that nonsense.
Yeah.
You have to play well. That's the message.
Totally, Joe. You're absolutely right. And it's not the occasion. You don't play the occasion. I certainly did the first year, but I can remember little things, Joe, like Mary Robinson was present at the time and we were told have your socks up when she shakes your hand, or it's 50 quid per player of a fine.
You were told by the Offaly County Board or by the GA?
Wait till I tell you, right? I always wore socks down. I never wore them up in the parade, but I did in 94. I did everything I was told in 94.
Yeah.
And I went down in 95, my socks down, and Eamon Cregan came over to me as we were making our way to line up for the present. He says, remember the socks. Socks, all socks have to be up. And I looked at him and I walked on and I thought to myself, socks up? Oh, Eamon, do you know what? No, I'll learn them fine. Effective, I'm going to pull my socks up for anybody. You know, I wasn't going to start recognising
the occasion.
The occasion.
Yeah, yeah,
so,
yeah,
do you
yeah.
know what? The president came around, and unlike the year before where I was crapping myself, put the head down and put the hand out, I smiled at her and shook her hand and she says, oh, you're nervous. I said, not too bad.
Yeah.
And then she moved on and I thought, right. Because I knew what I was going to do the minute the ball was going in, thrown in. I was going to strike Ollie Baker and I knew where I was going to hit him, and I did, and I opened him.
Oh, you shouldn't have done that.
No, Joe, I'm saying to you as it was. I knew premeditated for the throw in what I was going to do.
Do you regret that now?
No, I don't, because the year before Mike Houlihan did it to me in the throw in.
Right.
And he hit me under the ribs and he took my breath and I didn't get it back for 10 minutes and I never got into the game. And I swore this is never going to happen to me again. And I deliberately did what I did to Ollie Baker. And from the point of view of taking Ollie Baker out of the game, it pretty much worked. And I dominated him and I turned around and, like I said, 16 seconds, he was lying on the ground. And I remember looking, the blood was spurting over his head. And after 16 seconds, the ball came to the middle of the field and I put it over and I went down to him and at whatever obscenities I shouted. Yeah. I was doing it for me.
Jeez.
I was saying to him, this is my
this
day.
Is war.
You're not breaking me. I'm breaking you. I've just broke you. I remember turning to Whelan, who was right half back at him. Fergal Hegarty, he was marking. I remember saying to Whelan, he's finished, and Whelan giving me the fist. So it's a ruthless business.
It sure
really is a ruthless
it's war.
Business.
6 years?
6 years,
six
actually,
years.
Yeah, 2011, 10:47 in the morning on the 25th of January 2011. It sort of lives with you forever, that, because
yeah.
I lived through it once with my dad having Parkinson's disease, and it eventually took him away from us. And to get the diagnosis myself was a real shock, but I've decided to do everything that my dad didn't do. He hid himself away, didn't tell anybody about his diagnosis, ate meals away from the family, and basically got depressed and took his own life in the end, which was a really sad way to go. I'm upfront about it, living carpe diem, seizing the day, and hopefully be on the television for another couple of years at least.
How quickly did you reach that mindset? Like, so you leave on the 25th of January 2011 and you walk out and everybody's going about their business and your life's utterly changed. How quickly do you get to a point where you can take the other road?
Well, I kept it a secret for 2.5 years, and I was doing a world championship boxing fight in Glasgow, and I was hiding in a cupboard trying to put my cufflinks on, and the countdown was going to me being on air, and I was struggling with the buttons, struggling with cufflinks, struggling with a tie, and I thought, this is ridiculous. I hadn't told anybody, I hadn't told the makeup lady, I hadn't told any of my colleagues, and I just thought, this is absolutely mad. So I decided to go public, and went public in the biggest possible way. Did an article in the Daily Mail newspaper, told the whole story, and I haven't looked back really. It's a difficult decision to go public about private issues, but in the end, it was the right thing to do, and Sky have been very supportive.
I presume one of the reasons you're fearful of going public is you don't want to lose your job, first and foremost.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people with Parkinson's, you know, you're seen as disabled, you're seen as you know, surplus to requirements when you come out with a chronic degenerative neurological condition. I mean, I'm not going to get better unless we find a cure.
Mm.
And I'll end up in a wheelchair, I'll end up losing my voice. And it's a sad end in Parkinson's, but hopefully that's a long way off. But we'll find a cure before that.
Yeah, because I've seen you talk about guys like Michael J. Fox, Freddie Roach, like, and you're very much on that list now. There's people who live with it very heroically and publicly and refuse to let it take them before it takes them.
Well, you've got two choices, haven't you? You can either hide away, you know, sit in a corner, don't go out. I get up, attack every day.
Mm.
You know, around about my anniversary time, I always have something to look forward to.
Right.
And I don't know whether you know, I'm a massive Bruce Springsteen fan.
Right.
So basically my treat every January is going to see Bruce somewhere in the world. So I saw where he was playing in January. It's absolutely ridiculous. He's playing in Perth, Australia.
Wow.
So I thought, right, that's it. I'm off to see the boss in Perth. So me and a mate again in a couple of weeks time to see the boss in Perth Arena. Do a bit of wine tasting down that Perth coast and basically enjoy life and always have something to look forward to.
Yeah, that's a great point. That is Carpe Diem, going to see Bruce in Perth.
Well, he makes you feel good, you know.
Mm.
Bruce Springsteen concert, there's nothing quite like it. I've seen him in Dublin, I've seen him in Cape Town, New York, Madrid at the Bernabeu.
Right. Have you read the book?
I've read the book, I've seen the film, I've got the audio book, yeah.
I haven't.
I've got a little shrine in my office of tickets over the years. It's mad.
I haven't read the book. I'm hearing good things.
It's a really interesting insight into a guy, you know, who suffered from depression himself.
Mm.
The black dog was on his shoulder and, you know, touring and in with a band and getting out there is what he does. Even on the dark days, he tries to perform. So learn a lot from the boss.
Yeah, I can imagine. Like, well, I like the resilience. Like, I saw you did an interview recently where you said you've just learned to write with your left hand.
Yeah.
Just be practical and do it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, on a bad day, I can't do buns up on my shirt. You know, I can't write my name. So I thought, well, I'm going to teach myself to write left-handed. So throughout the World Championship, I was doing my notes left-handed if I couldn't write right-handed.
Yeah.
So just things like that. I get out of exercise every day because exercise helps neuroplasticity. If you've got any neurological problems, people listening, get out, exercise, go walking, walk across England if you can, coast to coast.
Because I didn't realise 1 in 500 affected, so that's plenty of people listening to the show right now.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's sort of a silent one. People don't talk about it, Parkinson's.
Mm.
But I've met people who have been diagnosed aged 29, 30 years of age.
Right.
You know, Twitter and Facebook are amazing things. You get in contact with people. And loads of people have been in touch with me. I mean, people say I'm an inspiration, but I just think I'm dealing with it day to day. I don't really feel like I'm inspirational, but...
No, trust me, you are. You definitely are, honestly. Somebody says, great to hear Dave on the show. Seems to be a presenter who genuinely enjoys his job and loves his sport. Nothing showbiz about Dave, just a good bloke who's well-informed and enjoyable to watch on the telly. He never hogs the limelight, says Bill. Is that something you try and bring to your broadcasting?
I think it's all about the guests, you know. I think bringing out the best in your guests, it's not about me. You know, you're doing a World Championship boxing fight. It's about the athletes involved and getting the best build-up for them. You know, they're the stars, not the broadcaster.
Mm.
Broadcaster's all about getting the best out of the guests. You know, Wayne Mardle, John Parr, Rod Harrington. You shouldn't really notice the presenters. You're just seamlessly linked between the guests and the live action.
It's interesting you say that because a colleague who was in earlier, Dave, was saying that one of the key word he would describe you on air, the quality is calmness. Just very calm all the time. Is that something you work on?
I do get nervous before I go on air. And I do have to get my medication right. You're probably stammering slightly now because my medication's running out and I don't like to take any more than I need to. But when I'm on air, you have to stay calm because if I don't stay calm, then the symptoms of Parkinson's rear their ugly head.
Yeah.
When the panic sets in, you know, sometimes I have to jam my hand. I'd be shaking. I'd jam my hand down the side of the chair. I'd be shaking and showing on air.
Mm.
You know, it's ridiculous at times, but everybody knows I've got Parkinson's. So, you know, it does take pressure off you.
Well, the bravery to come on live national radio in Ireland and say, I'm probably stammering a bit because I haven't taken my medication is an amazing thing. Like most people would say, I'll pass on the radio interview.
No, I think it's important that people hear you can live your life with Parkinson's. You know, it's important that you get the message out, you can live a life, you can get out there. And even though my voice isn't as strong tonight, you know, when I'm on air next time, I'll make sure I have plenty of medication, make sure I'm completely ready. But you know, for you guys, I just wanted you to hear that, you know, I'm not always as clear and concise as I normally am on air. So you can't hide it. You can't hide away. You've got to be out there and up front.
Obviously, he invited Paul Kimmage in initially and then got rid of him. Did that not set off alarm bells that Brailsford might not be the man that he was pretending to be? For you going in there?
Yeah, I mean, Paul was in the team for a few days and it didn't work out. And my understanding, you know, from, you know, at that time was that, you know, it just didn't work as a relationship. And
but if Brailsford was really serious about this, then surely a guy in there who even was upsetting people a little bit might be exactly the guy, if he was very genuine about this, to have in there.
Yeah, Dave Brailsford's view at the time when he was proposing to me, he said, you know, he was taking responsibility for why it didn't work with Paul, in the sense that he said, you know, we invited Paul to join us at the Tour de France. Crazy. When we're all stressed and none of the guys know him, he said, if you're going to come, you've got to come to the training camp in January, which I did. So by the time the Tour de France came around, I was a very familiar face and I knew people. And it was a very different situation. And I could see that. I mean, if somebody says to you...
Should they have re-invited him if it didn't work at the Tour, then come back again the following year?
Perhaps, you know.
Okay,
I mean,
fair enough. Yeah, okay. There was one other thing, and I just wanted to ask you about this, because I've heard you speak brilliantly before about how in 1999, post-Festina, you looked at the speeds Lance was doing and you thought, this doesn't make sense. This ain't right. And I've seen other quotes, you know, when Vinokourov and Rasmussen were put out of the Tour. You were looking at Contador's speeds and you thought, do you know what? I'm not so sure about this either. And yet Froome has done remarkable speeds, comparable with Lance. And it's not just down to technology. We've talked to enough people to know it's not just down to better bikes. I've never understood fully why you haven't looked at Froome's speeds and some of his performances and been... You know, curious, if not unconvinced. You've never explained that well enough for me. I don't understand why you've looked at Froome's performances.
Well, I mean, the thing about Lance in 1999 was that Jean-Marie Leblanc had said there will be much less drugs in the 1992 than there was in 1998 and previous years, and you will see it in slower time, slower overall time. And 1999 turned out to be the fastest tour in history at that time. So I use that as a kind of a reason for wondering. But then, within no time, we had a positive test for cortisone for Lance. Triamcinolone, you know, same corticosteroid that Bradley Wiggins was using for his three big races in 2011, 2012 and 2013. So that was like an overwhelming reason for doubting Lance. He tested positive and they covered it up. So... Yes, I did mention, and I may, well, I don't remember mentioning anything about Contador speeds. I certainly remember looking at Rasmussen and thinking he was like, the kind of speeds he could do in the mountains looked like seriously impressive if you were being positive, or seriously suspicious if you weren't being. The reason I don't, and you're right, I mean, I did mention it in 99 for sure, but I also would have mentioned Christoph Basson 50 times more, because that was far more significant to me. Christoph Basson, I'm not a good guy to start talking science, but because I don't understand it.
I was curious why there are people raising questions about Froome's performance that you didn't go and try and speak to somebody who did understand the science more. Speak to a Ross Tucker, these kind of people who are asking questions. You know, like put the burden of proof on the athlete.
I spoke to tons of people, you know. They say, you know, Froome was faster on Vaughan 2 than Armstrong was. And I say, what was the wind like that day? I don't know. I mean,
But in 2013, when Froome went up stage 8 of the Bonascura AX3 De Man, he did it in 23 minutes, 14 seconds into a headwind. And that beat Lance's time of 03 and 05. It didn't beat his time of 01, but he did that into a headwind. Like, I don't know if that's judge and jury he's done. But there should be huge questions, though.
And in 2003 and 2005, how many climbs had Lance gone over before that time?
I appreciate that point. But given the trajectory of Froome's career, of Froome's career, that he was capable of this, David... I just don't know I don't know how anyone listening could sign off on Froome.
Yeah, well, you know, I could have sat on the fence, you know, and then I would never have been wrong,
There's nothing wrong with saying I'm not sure.
Yeah, but if I believed in the guy, I'd be telling a lie.
But that's my point. I don't know how you can believe in him fully in light of those performances and his trajectory. I think it's okay. I think it's okay to say I'm not sure. It's too early to say. Then that's fine to say in 2013, 14, 15.